Tell me about it. If I leave these behind, I'm in bad trouble.
Morning, Counsel.
Morning, Chief Justice Sentell. May it please the court. My name is David Yerushalmi, and I represent appellants, the plaintiffs below. We are here today appealing the lower court's dismissal of the RICO conspiracy count. In essence, the court's dismissal relied on two legal holdings. One, my clients lacked standing because the RICO conspiracy defendants engaged in a cover-up subsequent to the incurring of damages by my clients. And two,
not exactly the logical progression I would have seen in that. I'm not sure what you'd be called standing or claim for relief. They didn't say it. They could, you had a cause and effect between engaging in a cover-up and the dismissal. If there'd been no cover-up, the dismissal would have been on exactly the same grounds, wouldn't it?
I'm not sure I understand the court's.
What the court really did was hold that there is no clear allegation of a conspiracy to commit a RICO violation by which your clients were harmed.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's what the court held.
In essence, that's exactly what the court did. It effectively rewrote the complaint and said,
you're changing what the court did again. The court didn't rewrite the complaint. The court held that you had not adequately alleged and probably couldn't adequately allege.
So let's address
a
that
RICO violation.
Let's address that specific point.
Yeah.
And we point to the actual allegations that we bring forward in the reply brief. At paragraph 2 of the complaint, and I'm now turning to page 7 of the reply brief, where we literally bring forward the specific allegations in the complaint. Paragraph 2 of the complaint, appearing on page 7 of the gray reply brief, begins by setting up the date that Mr. Days is employed in June 2006.
Which you tell us expressly arises out of a scheme to cover up a wide-reaching fraud.
In other words, the original conspiracy.
In other words, you allege a conspiracy to cover up.
Exactly right.
But you have not, in that paragraph at least, alleged a conspiracy to commit a RICO violation ab initio from which your clients were injured.
Except the cover-up includes the RICO violations. For example, paragraph 3, Days was not and never has been an attorney Care knew or should have known.
And knew or should have known is not conspiracy language. That's negligence or at most reckless disregard language. That's not a conspiracy allegation, is it?
Except that recklessness has been included by almost every court that's addressed it as intent and part of conspiracy. We see it in Rule 10b-5.
When has the court said that you could recklessly or negligently conspire?
Not negligently. Because
when has a court said that you could recklessly or negligently? Now, you didn't use the word reckless. I gave you a toss on that one, but when has a court said you could recklessly or negligently conspire?
Well, again,
give me your best case.
Well, we have Rule 10b-5 cases.
Give me your best case for that proposition.
The best case for that proposition was the court's in the opening brief, we cite to Ernst and Ernst v. Hockfelder, the U.S. Supreme Court, on page 36, where the court says explicitly, we have previously reserved the question whether reckless behavior is sufficient for civil liability under Section 10b and Rule 10b-5. Courts go on to cite other cases, Howard v. SEC. A secondary violator may act recklessly and thus aid and abet an offense even if he is unaware that he is assisting illegal conduct. A secondary offender conspiring with others through a reckless disregard.
You're leaving the quotation from the court now.
Pardon me?
You're leaving the quotation from
yes,
the court.
Yes, I am, Your
when
Honor.
You got the conspiracy language, you had left the court.
I ended at, in,
that's
he is
the best
assisting.
You've got on that.
He is assisting illegal conduct. Now, what is the illegal conduct here? The illegal conduct here is the fact that CARE Virginia headed up by one of the Care RICO defendants, Mr. Iqbal, knew or recklessly disregarded the fact that Mr. Moore's Days was not an attorney and that they were all going to be representing to the public that, in fact, he was a licensed attorney and concealing the fact that he was not an attorney. That was the essential part of the conspiracy.
I realize we've not yet reached the stage in litigation of testing credibility, but looking at these allegations, why on earth would the employer have conspired to hire somebody who wasn't qualified for the job they were hiring him for?
A very good question, Your Honor, and indeed we...
One that troubled me. I thought it was a good question myself, Counsel. I appreciate it.
And indeed, at page 23 of the reply brief, motive. CARE represents itself as America's largest American Muslim civil rights organization. In fact, the U.S. Attorney, the Department of Justice, and the FBI have identified CARE as an unindicted co-conspirator in the largest federal case regarding financing of terrorism.
How does any of that go to how they would have something to gain by hiring somebody who was not qualified to do the job they hired him for?
Because CARE in Virginia could not have found a legitimate attorney prepared to go to work with this organization that didn't have a like mind. Mr. Nihad Awad, who today is an executive director and one of the CARE RICO defendants, was at the Philadelphia meeting taped by the U.S. government in 1993, which was very much a part of the Holy Land Foundation trial, in which they said the way to promote our goals in this country in engaging in jihad abroad and promoting Hamas's ultimate ends, we need to establish so-called legitimate civil rights organizations. The co-founder of CARE was at that same meeting, Mr. Omar Ahmed. Both of these men, one of which resigned only in 2005, were the founding members of this organization. Their organization is predicated upon a criminal conspiracy. The Department of Justice has made it very public and has distanced themselves and said,
"No, for the life of me, I still can't see how any of that would be a motive for them to hire somebody for a job they knew he was not qualified for."
You're now running an operation. You've been identified as an unindicted co-conspirator in support and financing of terrorism. You go out to find yourself attorneys to head up these little branch offices. You can't find one. Moore Stays shows up. Now, you don't check. Let's assume for the sake of discussion that Mr. Iqbal did not know he was a fraud. What was the resume he was given? It wasn't that he was simply an attorney. He was a stellar attorney, a graduate of Temple University Law School, a member of the Philadelphia Bar Association since 1997. He had received the Southern Poverty Law Center's Rosa Parks Memorial Wall Award. No such award exists. How could Mr. Iqbal have determined any of that resume? A phone call, the way I did. A single phone call. An ordinary employer who hires someone to represent clients and uses those representations of a stellar resume to collect charitable contributions from an unsuspecting public, an ordinary employer would be liable for reckless hiring. In this case, you have a...
You're not suing for reckless hiring. You're suing for a RICO conspiracy, which requires allegations that the underlying RICO acts caused damage to your client.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And what are those...
I have no problem that you can't hire this person without being reckless.
So what does the recklessness go to? The recklessness goes to the fact that there was a conspiracy when Mr. Days was hired in June 2006. If that is the case...
Where is that alleged in your complaint? I'm looking at your complaint.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Where is that alleged in your complaint? That there was a conspiracy the day he was hired.
The conspiracy, first of all, as we see in paragraphs 2 and 3, that he's hired knowingly or recklessly. Again, if you turn to page 8, paragraph 22.
Page 8 of what?
Of the reply brief, Your Honor.
The reply brief. Get back to the complaint.
Yeah, tell me about the complaint.
It cites the allegations.
Get back to the complaint and tell us what's alleged there.
The complaint says at all relevant times.
What paragraph of the complaint?
Paragraph 22 of the complaint. And that paragraph is quoted in full in paragraph 8, page 8, excuse me, of the reply brief, or in the appendix at page 18.
That doesn't allege a conspiracy.
Uh-uh.
At all relevant times, CARE National and CARE Virginia knew or should have known by the exercise of ordinary due diligence that Days was not actually a lawyer.
What do you do with paragraph 32?
Initially, Mr. Iqbal knows or recklessly disregards the fact that Mr. Days is not an attorney in June of 06. Later, there's an add-on scheme. And in fact, in every area where the complaint...
Neither Iqbal nor CARE made any effort at that time, which is November 2007, or in the months following this discovery, right, to inform CARE clients that Days had criminally defrauded them. And therefore, Iqbal was joining the Days fraud scheme, entered into a conspiracy with Days. All of that is talking about November 2007 and beyond.
Right.
Not when he was hired in 2006.
Is the conspiracy, Your Honor? In June of 2006, when CARE employed Days, that is an agreement. Now, indeed,
asking you the same question. Where we're going through the complaint, and I haven't seen a paragraph that alleges a conspiracy beginning in June 2006, and that's what I'm asking.
The definition of a conspiracy is an agreement between two parties to engage in illegal conduct.
I know what a conspiracy is. I'm asking
that,
where in the complaint is the allegation that I'm asking?
The conspiracy arises out of, you won't find, and we concede this, the word conspiracy in June of 2006, but it is in effect there. Because you have two parties.
So there's no allegation in the complaint to support the reformulation of the case in your opening brief in this court.
We would respectfully disagree, Your Honor.
Well, then where is it?
Where is it? Both of us have been asking.
I understand that.
Since you got up here, you haven't shown it to us. Where is it?
If the complaint alleges an agreement between two parties to engage in illegal conduct, that is by law a conspiracy. Now, did we use the magical term conspiracy at that point? No, we use it throughout the complaint. But at that point in June of 2006, by agreeing to employ Days knowingly or recklessly, as a matter of law, we have a conspiracy.
Have you ever found a case where the court held that allegations of recklessness were sufficient to be allegations of conspiracy?
Well, again, I pointed to at least two cases in which...
You did not point to anywhere in those cases that the court held that an allegation of recklessness is sufficient to make a conspiracy.
Your Honor, I thought I did.
Well, you...
I could return to the case...
Ernst and Ernst v. Huckfelder.
...of Howard v. SEC, 376 F3rd 1136. It's cited at page 36 of our opening brief. This court held, and I'm quoting now, a secondary violator may act recklessly and thus aid and abet an offense even if he is unaware that he is assisting illegal conduct, end quote. That
doesn't seem to be answering the question we're asking you. The word conspiracy nor conspire, neither of them appeared in what you just quoted, Jim.
There's no question. Well, a conspiracy is, in fact, very much a part of aiding and abetting.
No, it's not.
No, it's not. And it has to be an agreement.
That's true.
There
has to be an agreement. Exactly correct.
You can aid and abet
without an agreement.
Exactly.
And in this case, we have an agreement in June of 2006. What is the agreement? The employment contract. They employ Mr. Days knowingly or recklessly disregarding the fact that he was not an attorney. I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
We'll see. Thank you, counsel. You don't need to hear him.
No.
I think we have your position from the brief, counsel, unless my colleagues have further questions.
No questions. May I make one line of argument? Because I'd like to answer for the court how a case of essentially claim of negligent hiring, where people lost at most $1,000, ends up being a RICO case that gets to this court.
I think we get the argument.
Yeah, I think we do.
I hope that the court will address.
When I was a very young attorney, an old attorney told me, when the judge is arguing your side of the case, don't interrupt his train of thought.
I hope the court will address the frivolous nature of the case in its opinion. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. There's nothing requiring rebuttal, so the case will be submitted.
Case number 09-5377.
Good morning, Mr. Clement.
Chief Judge Sintel, and may it please the court. There's no dispute that insurance premiums are a reasonable and necessary cost of operating a hospital, and there's no suggestion that the premiums at issue here were too expensive or too high, nor is there any real dispute concerning the solvency of the foreign captive at issue here or its ability to meet its obligations. Despite all this, the board treated insurance payments being paid to this foreign captive as non-reimbursable. It did so by relying on the manual provision and treating that manual provision as, in its own words, compulsory. Now, there's two problems with that reasoning of the board. One is, this case came to the board on the concession that the foreign captive did not comply with the equity limits in the manual provision at issue. But equally importantly, the manual provision at issue here does not purport to be a legislative rule. It can't simply be treated as compulsory and then further reasoning dispensed with. So that leaves the board's decision here essentially unexplained. The closest the board comes to an explanation of its decision rests on a faulty premise. That is the premise that there's some regulatory gap here that needs to be filled, that there's a fundamental difference in the way that foreign captives and domestic captives are regulated. And on that point, the board and the secretary are simply wrong. The vast majority of domestic captives are subject neither to any equity cap on their investment nor to generally onerous regulations. And so in that sense, the foreign captives that are at issue here are not subject to differential treatment for those purposes. So a regulatory regime that's premised on a regulatory gap that doesn't exist seems to me to be the definition of an arbitrary and capricious agency decision. Now, the Secretary, of course, looks at this argument and
let me take you back just a moment to the assertion that the regulatory gap doesn't exist. Domestic captive companies would be subject to state regulation, right?
They would be subject to state regulation in the same way that a foreign captive is subject to regulation by a foreign government.
Well, Cayman Islands is not exactly the regulatory equal of the state of New York, right?
Well, I think when it comes to this issue, the Cayman Islands is Vermont with better weather, Your Honor, because Vermont has made a conscious decision here.
Nonetheless, the rationality of the United States relying on the stability of the government and regulatory authorities of Vermont is very different than relying upon the same attributes of the Cayman Islands, isn't it?
Well, I mean, Your Honor, first of all, I think that the Cayman Islands.
I've been in business long enough to remember Cayman Islands banking, but. I don't think you would have wanted to entrust your money to some of the Cayman Islands banks that we confronted.
Well, I mean, a couple of points to keep in perspective here, though. One is, Your Honor, with respect to commercial insurance, foreign insurance can be purchased, and that's reimbursable. So this is a regulation that focuses specifically on foreign captives. Now, if you look at foreign captives, then, and compare it to domestic captives are the area in which insurance is the least regulated by the state. And I mentioned Vermont in particular because Vermont has essentially established itself as the Delaware of captive insurer regulators, and it's done this by essentially withdrawing and deregulating. And so it does seem to me that while as a general matter you could have some sympathy for an agency that says we're worried about the absence of regulation in some of these foreign countries, that's not been the general approach to insurance reimbursement by the Secretary. And in the particular area of captive insurers, it seems like her regulatory structure is at its weakest because the domestic captives are essentially left unregulated.
Isn't your best argument not that this is a bad idea, but simply that they didn't have the legislative authority to do this at all?
Well, it's hard to pick among very good arguments, Your Honor. I think that this is a situation where, as we state in Roman 1 of our brief, that this really strikes us as ultra-virus regulation.
Did you argue that in the district court?
We did argue that in the district court. I'm not sure we argued it in exactly the same terms, Your Honor, but we've argued from the beginning that this is regulation that is essentially beyond the Secretary's capability.
Statutory authority.
Beyond the statutory authority. I mean, we started even before the agency essentially saying, look, what you've done here is essentially tried to regulate the business of insurance. That's something that is ultra-virus. I think as the case has come to this court, we've focused on the extraterritorial aspects of this as well.
Does the IRS, in certain instances, insurance premiums are tax deductible. And I think the IRS has a whole system for determining whether captive offshore insurance companies qualify for the deduction. Is that the IRS regulating insurance? And where do they get the authority to do that?
Well, I would say this. I mean, I think that if to the extent that I'm not as familiar with the IRS regime as you are, Your Honor, but I would say that in that context, certainly the IRS has a necessary role in regulating the deductibility of certain expenses and the like. And so they can make certain regulations about whether or not something is actually an expense. I think even the IRS would have some limits on the extent to which they could go beyond.
Isn't that the theory that the government is employing here? That, look, we know the premiums are cheaper, but paying a premium doesn't get you anything unless that the company that stands behind it is prepared to pay a claim. And whether a company is prepared to pay a claim or whether you're buying a pig in a poke depends upon the financial stability of that company. So we have this test for determining whether the insurance company is financially stable.
Judge Randolph, I would concede that maybe the Secretary has some sort of backstop, limited authority to make sure that when you're purchasing insurance, that you're actually purchasing insurance. And that would be an argument that the Secretary could use to try to defend a regime that had a very limited concept that sort of said, look, we want to...
Suppose the captive offshore company had no reserves?
Well, there are...
Can the IRS, or the IRS, the can Medicare disallow that?
I think they probably could, because without reserves, it probably wouldn't be insurance. It's worth emphasizing, there's another provision of the manual that we don't challenge in this proceeding that does require the insurance companies to have adequate reserves, that does make sure that for captives that a company doesn't pay more in premiums than you would pay for comparable commercial insurance. So it seems to me there are those aspects of the manual that really exhaust the Secretary's legitimate role.
But captive companies, so I mean that would be like shooting yourself in the foot if you're paying premiums to a company that has no reserves, and you own that company. I don't know what the sense of that would be.
And Your Honor, that's precisely why the states have essentially largely withdrawn and deregulated the business of captive insurance. If you think about commercial insurance, states have a very legitimate role to make sure that people have sort of belief in the stability of the insurance companies. With respect to a captive, there's an understanding by the states that the people that are creating the captive insurance company have every incentive to regulate those and run those prudently. And that's why, you know, the Secretary comes to this court and tells the court that she has a legitimate role here in ensuring that she gets value for her expenditure. But surely the company that I represent here has a much more direct stake in getting value for its expenditure. And as you go beyond the basic reimbursement regulation role, which is to make sure the costs are reasonable and not substantially out of line, and that you're actually getting something for your money, then I think the Secretary's legitimate regulatory role is at an end.
The manual is not as simple as saying you can't have more than 10% of your money in equity securities. I mean, it goes through, it tells you you should have the debt securities of the United States or U.S. corporations. And, I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And I'd like to hear from the government on this, but I look at that and I wonder, how is this an interpretive rule?
Yeah.
It's anytime you get into numbers with percentages and so on and so forth, I begin to wonder, and I guess maybe I'm making a speech, but I mean, one of the things the Supreme Court does, as you know, it doesn't set down, in federal statutes, it doesn't set down a statute of limitations because that looks like legislating. That's not interpreting. What they do is they borrow one from the state to try to get around it and make it appear more judicial. But I guess my question really is, have you argued this is not, I know you argued it's not a legislative rule because it's in a manual, but did you argue it's not even a proper interpretive rule?
Well, I think we have said that it is not a proper interpretive rule, which would be entitled to deference because it's, in fact, inconsistent with the statute and the regulation. So we've made that argument, Your Honor. I would say that the way we focused on this is we've tried to take the Secretary at her word in this case and say, okay, you view it as an interpretive rule. If it's an interpretive rule, I agree with you, it's already on thin ice with the unbelievable particularity with which it regulates things. I mean, you left out my favorite provision that you can't invest by a single share of a stock that doesn't pay a dividend, that's somehow
verboten.
And so you have that kind of approach. It looks very legislative and not interpretive. And then, of course, when the board comes to interpret it, they say, I think this is on Joint Appendix page 172, they say the manual provision is compulsory. And so that, to me, sounds like the board itself is applying the rule in a way that's legislative. But again, in their briefs, they come back and say, no, this is an interpretive rule. I think if you look at this provision, as we say, there's really two fundamental defects. There's a defect we've talked about, which is this is very much ultra virus. I liken it to the Secretary simply saying, we're going to have a Buy American rule for everything because, you know, with respect to plastic gloves and things like that, we can fall back on state tort systems to make sure they're good products.
My position is that if they had gone through a notice and comment rulemaking and received whatever substantial evidence that would support what appears in the manual, that even then they couldn't promulgate this rule.
That is both our position and obviously the logical import of our position. I would say this, though, and this is really the second argument that's in Roman 2, which is, if there was notice and comment rulemaking, as there should have been if the Secretary wanted to promulgate a legislative rule with this kind of specificity, I think the Secretary would have ultimately issued a different rule. Because if this is supposed to be a rule to ensure the solvency, it really comes up short in many respects.
High-level argument. Your first argument is they couldn't do this at all. The second one is, even if we lose on that, then they didn't go through the proper process.
Right, and it's actually a trial-level argument because we also have an argument that it doesn't make – if what these are solvency rules to make sure that you get your insurance premiums, which are essentially an accrual of the underlying liability expense, the worst thing that would happen if you commit some kind of foot fault and you can't deduct or get reimbursement for your payments, your premiums in real time, then the consequence of that should not be that you don't get reimbursement for anything. It should be that you have to wait until you actually incur the liability, which logically is something that also should be reimbursable. I'd like to save some time for rebuttal, if I may.
Good morning, counsel.
Good morning, Chief Judge Santel. May it please the court. I'm Irene Sollett, representing the Secretary of Health and Human Services. The Secretary has authority under the general reasonable cost statutory standard and under the necessary and proper.
That's your best argument for statutory authority.
Well, that is the statutory authority, Your Honor. That's what the board relied
How
on.
How does the nature of the equity holdings of the captive insurer go to the reasonable cost?
Your Honor, it goes to reasonable cost because it relates to whether, in a very fundamental sense, whether when the Secretary, when the Medicare program is spending taxpayer dollars for health care, it is getting what it's paying for. Is it putting that money out there to get a good or service that it will actually obtain? Now, the providers here argue that this is a standardless and boundless concept. But if the court looks at the actual decision that was made by the board here and that's before you, it's really very narrow and targeted. It's a decision and the outcome of an adjudication, which concludes that an offshore captive insurance company, its premiums are not reimbursable to the Medicare provider because of its investment allocations.
That's a statement of what the case is about.
But that applies.
That's not a justification for what the Secretary did.
But, Your Honor, it applies only to insurance companies that are wholly owned by Medicare providers. It applies only to such companies that are located offshore. And it doesn't directly limit the conduct of the insurance company.
Why shouldn't it apply to Lloyd's of London? All your arguments would be exactly the same. As a matter of fact, your arguments would be stronger if it was not a captive offshore insurance company. Because a captive insurance company, the Medicare provider has every reason in the world to make sure they're financially stable. Otherwise, because they're on the hook. If they get claims that can't be paid, it's their problem.
Your Honor, the board, in its decision, articulated basically two rationales for its conclusion that the application of the manual provision was appropriate here, and I would...
Compulsory, not appropriate.
No, Your Honor, I don't think it's fair to read the board's decision as a conclusion that the manual provision was compulsory, end of...
Investment restrictions of HCFA, the rest of the citation... are a valid extension and are therefore compulsory.
Your Honor,
it's not fair to read compulsory to mean compulsory.
But, Your Honor, what follows there is a discussion of the reasons why the policy makes sense here. So I would submit that it's really not fair to read this decision as a finding.
Not fair to read compulsory as meaning compulsory.
It doesn't reflect in this sense that the board felt itself to be bound by the regulation and wasn't going to listen to any other arguments. I think it's clear that the board understood that it was not bound by the manual provision. The outcome was not foreordained. If that were the case, there would be no several-page discussion of the reasons for the decision.
I'm confused. You refer to this as a regulation, the manual is a regulation. But the board, it's an interpretive.
If I referred to it as a regulation, Your Honor, I misspoke. The manual is, by its own terms, not binding. It does not have the force and effect of law. The board understands that.
What is it, then? Is this an interpretive rule?
It is, Your Honor.
Okay.
And
which the board is free to disregard?
The board is free to disregard
interpretive rules.
And the it's a guideline, Your Honor.
Yeah.
And the
So what we have here is
what we have is
an adjudication.
We have
a rule that was set to, or a decision embodying a legal principle as a result of an adjudication? Is that what we have?
That is what we have, Your Honor.
Where does the board get the authority? What's the board interpreting here?
The board is interpreting and applying the reasonable cost standard and the Secretary's regulation, elaborating on that to the extent of saying that reasonable costs are those that are necessary and proper. And if I could refer the court to the Guernsey decision, what the value that has for us is simply the way that it lays out the structure of Medicare decision-making, and I apologize if I... Basically, what the manual is a guideline without binding force and effect. The evidence of that in this decision itself is the fact that there are two board members who said we wouldn't apply this manual provision. They weren't in the majority, but they felt free to do that, and that would not have been inappropriate conduct on their part to reach that conclusion. It wasn't. The majority of the board felt otherwise. So what we have is a guideline which is applied through
at least one of the dissenters, maybe both. I think both. They're both joined. Said that this violates the plain meaning of the provisions controlling Medicare statutes and regulations.
And the majority of the board disagreed.
So yeah, but you're now asserting that this is not a binding regulation because they felt free to disregard it. They didn't feel free to disregard it. They said it was invalid.
That's not the same thing.
Well, if it's valid. The majority would say this is valid and binding.
Your Honor,
the dissent seems to be saying it can't be binding because it's not valid.
The manual itself states in the foreword that its provisions are not binding and do not have the force and effect of law.
The board acted rationally and lawfully here when the board says it's compulsory?
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that read in total, the board reaches the conclusion that the policy articulated in the manual provision is appropriate. Your Honor, respectfully, I would disagree. I think that
it's right there, counsel. It's in black and white. You're entitled to your own opinion. You're not entitled to your own facts.
Your Honor, I don't believe I'm embroidering on the facts to say that that conclusion that it's compulsory is because, having listened to the arguments about why the manual provision should not be applied, the board rejects them. And thus it concludes that the manual provision is compulsory. I don't believe it starts at the outset and says it's compulsory.
I want to get back to a question I asked Mr. Clement. Suppose that, forget about deference for the moment, and suppose that now we have this issue about the validity of the board's rule, and you say it's an interpretation of reasonable costs. Is that
correct?
Right, okay. Suppose we as a court say, 10%, that's much too low. I think it should be 25%. And I think maybe U.S. debt securities, I don't know that, there's talk about the federal government or United States being downgraded by Moody's. So maybe they ought to invest in German bonds. And we'll put all that as an interpretation of reasonable costs in our opinion and reject your rule on that basis. Now, does that sound like a court legislating?
Your Honor, I
think... No, come on, come on. It does. It does, doesn't it?
But what we have here, Your Honor, is a record. As the court acknowledged, there are two levels of argument here. Does the secretary have the authority to be acting in this area at all? In other words, does the secretary have any authority under its broad her broad statutory power to reimburse reasonable costs and to reimburse under her own regulation costs that are necessary and proper? Under that authority, can she?
But you're avoiding the question. All questions of government are questions of ends and means. Right? You're talking about the ends. I'm talking about the means. So let's stick to the means.
All right, on the means.
How do you do it?
I think you
assume the end is proper, but can you do it by throwing it into a manual and then giving it to a board to adjudicate 10%?
You can give it to the board to adjudicate, Your Honor, and I think that Guernsey stands
without ever having gone through a notice and comment.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that Guernsey stands for the proposition that the specifics of...
What stands for that, I'm sorry?
The Guernsey case in the Supreme Court stands for the proposition that the technical specifics of the application of the broad Medicare standards are appropriately resolved through adjudication by the agency with the manual guideline as a tool, not as a given. And then I think, to answer Judge Randolph's question, how do we get to these technical questions about how much of what type of investment? That's really the part of this case that's about the record. Does the record here support the limitation that the board and then the secretary confirming imposed? And on that point, the board had two rationales. Both of them are important. But I would like to focus, because the court has not yet with counsel addressed the issue of the actual practice of comparable insurance companies. And that was one of the two rationales on which the board relied. There is discussion in the briefs about charts, which may be confusing in the end to the court. But I think the simplified and accurate summary of what that discussion is about is that both sides agree that the proper comparison group of companies is mutual insurance companies. And the disagreement is about the government's charts, which address mutual insurance companies that insure malpractice and workers' compensation liability, versus the provider's chart, which covers a broader category of property and casualty risks. The significance of this is that the charts on which the board relied, which are focused on those two kinds of risk, show an allocation to stocks by comparable mutual insurance companies between approximately 8 and 14%. There's testimony from the hearing in the record at pages 29 and 240 of the joint appendix that their financial officer said these were their two main risks. But even more important than that, at pages 405 and 410 of the joint appendix, you'll see a submission by the providers which shows that for the years 2000 to 2002, over 90% of their risk was in these two categories. So if there is evidence in the record that comparable, which both sides agree, comparable insurers, that is mutual insurers, and then those insurers that insure the vast bulk of the risk that's involved here are investing their assets in the range of the guideline applied through adjudication in this decision, that by itself, standing alone, is substantial evidence in the record supporting the board's decision here. If I turn to the question of state regulation, I would say that that's a two-step analysis, really. First of all, there is a void. The void is that there is no state statutory or regulatory structure that applies to these insurers. The secretary then looks at that and says, all right, I'm not comfortable with there being a total absence of oversight, of statutory regulatory oversight, what rule shall I impose? There, in the record, there are a few states that impose fixed limits on equity investments by captives. And there is, this provides a basis for the secretary to act here. And I would say that thus on both of these bases, both of the two rationales that the secretary, the board articulated in its decision and that the secretary adopted, there is substantial evidence in the record for the particular limitation that is imposed by this decision. So just to come back to the broader picture, at the broadest level, for the court to say that the secretary cannot regulate in this area at all, I think is really inconsistent with the provider's concession that at some outer limit, it is appropriate for the secretary to act. Once you accept that, once you accept the fact that the secretary can determine that wholly risky, transparently risky investing is not appropriate, then it's really a question of whether the record in this case is adequate, constitutes substantial evidence for the secretary's decision. And on that point, I would particularly again urge the court to look at the practice of comparable insurers and to look at pages 405 to 410 of the joint appendix and see that the bulk of the risk involved here, not just the majority, but over 90% of the insurance costs here are for malpractice and workers' compensation costs. It was appropriate for the board to look at what mutual insurers who invest, who cover that kind of risk, how they invest their assets. The evidence in the record showed that they invested approximately 8 to 14% in stock.
I just want to get clear about, I think I have it, but number one, this your position, number one, that the provision in the manual is an interpretive rule. Number two, that the board had authority to either accept it or reject it. And two members dissented on the basis that this wasn't proper under the regulation, right?
Right.
And three, that the interpretation is an interpretation in the rule, is an interpretation of the words reasonable costs.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, I would like to take that just one small step further. You set the Guernsey case as support for your proposition that the manual here could be an interpretive rule. The Guernsey case, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, dealt with general principles applicable to cost analysis as to whether the secretary had to apply GAAP. It was not, there was an interpretive regulation, but not with near the legislative specificity that you had here.
Well,
am I incorrect in that?
It may be more general in this case, but I wouldn't say it was exceedingly general. The issue there had to do with
bond
defeasance and the amortization period, and the manual provision said it had to be amortized over the period of the bond, and GAAP principles would have said 1 year. But I think it's a scale.
It was a much more general principle than what's involved in this case.
It was more general than in this case, but I think it still does support the idea that the structure of the Medicaid program is understood by the court to require this kind of technical adjudication.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. You had some time left. We'll give you, pardon? You have 3 minutes left for rebuttal, Mr. Clement.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to make 3 points. First of all, I think the fundamental problem with viewing what the board did and what the manual does as an interpretive rule is you have to ask the question, interpreting what? And if you look at the board decision, it does not look like a decision that purports to interpret the statutory or regulatory terms of reasonable or necessary. If it did, then presumably the two questions it would have asked were, one, were these premium payments too high? That issue isn't addressed at all. And then the second, perhaps other issue is there something about this first initiatives where they really didn't get insurance at all? Is this insolvent? Is this problematic? They didn't ask those questions at all. The board simply focused on the rule, treated it as if it were a legislative rule, and moved on. Relatedly, as the Chief Judge has already pointed out, nothing in the Guernsey case purported to repeal the APA for the Secretary. That was a case about the gap rules, as you correctly recall. And importantly, it talked about, of course, not every issue is going to be dealt with in the manual. And some issues are going to have to be dealt with in the manual. But it didn't say that what you can do is have a manual provision that has a legislative rule character, don't have notice and comment when you originally promulgate that quasi-legislative rule, and then in the process of adjudication, you somehow get to turn that into a legislative rule and not really justify the interpretive rule as an interpretation of the statute or the regulations. That's what happened here. Second point, Your Honor, if you want to look at charts, please look at Joint Appendix page 529. That's the relevant chart. This is a company that provided multiple lines of insurance, captives
that... All the way to your third level of argument when you do that.
Yeah, well, exactly. But I do think if you're going to look at charts, if you care about charts, the best one, the most directly relevant one, is JA 529.
The role of rebuttal. What do you say to counsel's point that by conceding that there is a level of unreasonableness in insurance investment risk as against which the Secretary could regulate, is that a concession that the Secretary can act in this area under the statute?
No, what it is a concession that there might be some role here in interpreting the idea of reasonable cost to say that you've essentially paid too much if you paid something for nothing. And so there's some very residual backstop role for the Secretary to play to make ensure that people are actually getting something.
To concede that the Secretary can examine and therefore perhaps regulate upon the investment portfolio of the insurer in order to make that determination.
With respect, I don't think that's the case. I think in answering the question, is this even insurance, which is the relevant question that the Secretary should be asking, you don't have to know whether the company invested 38% or 41% in equities. That is a completely different question that suggests that the Secretary simply lost her way here and got way into the details of something that's none of her business. And for that reason, I would urge the Court to go beyond simply correcting the Board for saying compulsory and give us kind of relief on the merits.
Does the record reflect that, the practice of captive offshore insurance companies is fairly common. Does the record reflect that other Medicare providers just don't seek reimbursement because they anticipate making it up by their equity investments?
Well, Judge Randolph, I don't think the record speaks directly to this question. I can tell you that my client had a unique problem here. I mean, a lot of companies would probably look at the manual provision, see that, boy, that looks pretty legislative, and I'm just going to locate in Vermont. My client had a particular problem here, which is they wanted to have some companies in the umbrella that were not wholly owned, and because of that, they couldn't go to Vermont. So they decided they would take their risks and litigate this issue. Without that very idiosyncratic detail, I'm not sure most companies would have had the incentive to litigate this issue. They probably would have looked at that manual provision, said, wow, that looks like legislation. I better abide by the legislation.
Or that I'm going to locate offshore because I can make more money by having the insurance company invest in equity securities.
That may be the problem is, of course, that if you didn't have this idiosyncratic problem, you could invest in all the equity securities you wanted and be domiciled in Vermont and get full reimbursement, which gets back to the absurdity of this rule. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. Give us a recess.